Today is March 30th, 2023. It's 20:43 hours Eastern Daylight Time, Ward Green here. We know that Jesus replaced the Passover sacrifice with his own sacrifice. He took the place of the Passover so that he died and became the Passover sacrifice, so that there were no more ever again Passovers. There were no more Passovers because Jesus became the sacrifice for the sin of Adam. And we know that when he died, of course, that was on the evening of, it was after the Lord's evening meal, but his sacrifice was the day after the Lord's evening meal. And his sacrifice replaced the Passover sacrifice, so he died on the actual anniversary of the Passover. Therefore, the evening meal was quite properly the night before for both him and his apostles, because Jesus wasn't going to be there the next night on the traditional Passover. So Jesus died on the day of the Passover. That's what happened. So the night before, Jesus and his apostles celebrated the Lord's evening meal one day early. And that just happened to be the same night that the Essenes celebrated that same Passover. For the Essenes, it was the night before the traditional Sadducee Passover in the year 30 CE. It just happened that way in that one year, 30 CE, which is the actual crucifixion year of Jesus. That's when it happened, and that's what we talked about in our article, Born and Raised, which you're welcome to read, by the way. The other thing for today, little children, is in the article Wild Road Ahead to History, Part 1, Chapter 5, Paragraph 6, we're talking about the admonitions of Ipuwer, which is an Egyptian document. And we have in Paragraph 5.4, we've talked about that already. We're at 5.5 now. And there's some more information in 5.6. We're not going to cover 5.6 today. But in 5.6, we will get to that. We will cover that. I have to correct myself on the paragraph number. It was 5.5. I was reading 5.6 in advance just to see what it was talking about. But I think today's 5.5, isn't it? Yeah. 5.5 is what it is. So, like all ancient events, the Exodus, oh my goodness, there's an actual typo here, which is interesting. I didn't notice that. Even today, I didn't see it. Like all ancient events, the Exodus is much easier to confirm when one knows when it was in time, or more so, when one knows precisely when. This is the concept, okay? This is a very important concept. It's a concept that we invented in the Crucible article. I was writing the Crucible article, and it suddenly occurred to me that, well, for one thing, we were always taught the history of other people. They taught us what dates were supposedly the correct dates for all of history, right? We were just given these numbers, these dates. It had never occurred to me that these dates we were given could be wrong, or that we could find a better set of dates for history. And in this investigation, it occurred to me that this concept, which we invented in that article, Crucible, as I was writing it, the idea that facts of history stand or fall within an exacting test created by the Crucible of a chronology. So you can prove whether something's true or not when you've got the correct chronology to compare the context with, and to compare the sequence of events within that chronology and how the other events surrounding it and you know, interspersed with those events in the true chronology, how they gain or lose meaning within the context of the chronology. You can see what's true and what's not true. It's an exacting test when you have the correct chronology. It becomes much more sensitive to the truth. So the facts of history stand or fall. In other words, you could say this fact is false because it doesn't fit with the true chronology. Within this exacting test created by the crucible of the true chronology, really, but we're calling it a chronology, some chronology, but it has to be the correct one in order for this to actually work. While our date for the exodus of Israel in 1493 from Egypt's new kingdom under Thutmose I, that's where we have that date. It's the exodus from Egypt under Thutmose I during his reign. And he died in that year, 14. Excuse me for a second here. He died in 1493 BCE. Our date for the exodus in that year from the new kingdom of Egypt under Thutmose I has remained secure throughout the duration of this test so far. It has at every stage been subject to possible rejection. Yet the date 1493 BCE has stood up to every test given by known fact. Okay, this is an important sentence. The date 1493 BCE has stood up to the date 1493 BCE has stood up to every test given by known fact. Something not true of other held dates. They don't hold up to every test. When they're subjected to the tests based on all the known facts, they don't hold up. This date does hold up. 1493 BCE does hold up. Many events are hidden in history simply because the precise dating of them prevents any meaningful search. So in other words, if something is dated wrong, then you can't find out the surrounding events or the other events related to it are hidden because they're in the wrong time period. Okay, and the details of what these correlated events mean, you know, these correlated and corresponding events that occurred around the same time, those details of the meaning of those other events that are related to these events, they're hidden. The meaning is hidden because they were not in the correct relative time when the history was dated wrong. So in the context, these things become lost and they become obscured and hidden. Time simply won't permit a broadband history search. You can't just say, we're going to find when something happened and we're going to search through all of history. You can't do that. You can't search through all of history to find when Jesus observed the Passover or evening meal before the Passover. You cannot find that by searching all of history. You have to know where to look, in other words. And it's true of every event in history. You have to know where to look in history to find the events. Even a slight error, I mean, just history is too vast. You can't just search everything in history. You couldn't search through all the layers in the ground if you're searching archaeologically, for example. You just can't search all of history. You have to know where to look. Even a slight error of dating changes meaning totally. In 1969, for example, Alan H. Gardner dated Ipuer, that's the admonitions of Ipuer, to about the time of the Hyksos of Egypt, based on an historical assessment of its contents. noting that earlier dating was possible only from philological and other aspects. Since modern scholars adopt a much lower dating for an Israelite exodus from Egypt, somewhere in the 1200s BCE, they see only that the Ipuwer document, the admonitions of Ipuwer, is too early. So is irrelevant to their particular discussion of evidence. They don't even care, because since they date the Exodus later, that document is irrelevant from their viewpoint. But they don't consider that maybe they're wrong in their date and that document is relevant. This is a remarkable example of how timing is crucial. Since it is irrelevant in their chronology, some since the time of Mr. Gardner have chosen the earlier date. In other words, well, we don't care what date it is. It's not relevant to the Exodus, so they make it date much earlier than it needs to. And that makes it too early for us in our chronology, for example. So we can't use their testimony or we can't use their published articles to support our case, because they choose a much earlier date than they need to, because to them it's irrelevant. So that's what's happening there. Okay, and then we're going to talk more about that hopefully tomorrow. But this is a fascinating thing with regard to history and how the events of history get lost because the chronology is not accurate. If you look at the crucifixion as being in a different year than 30 CE, you would not find what we found. You wouldn't find it. So you can read the article, Born and Raised. It's on the Will of Jehovah main page, right in the middle there of the section with the year text, and the most colorful part of that page really probably was all the rectangular colored sections. It's in the middle of that, and it's in several languages too. Born and Raised, it's got a few other names because it's got translated copies and versions of it, I should say. Different versions. It's got in Italian, nato e realizzato. Is that Italian? No. Wait a minute. I'm trying to think if that's... Yeah, that's Italian, I think. Yes, that's the Italian copy. And then in Romanian, nascut și a crescut. Rodil se va sozdan. In Russian, zrozen a znovu zrozen. In the Czech language, geboren gebunden in the German language, nacido y criado in Spanish. So these are the different translations. And oh my goodness, what language is that? I'm trying to remember what that is. We've got Japanese, I think, don't we? Let's see what we've got here. What do we have? What is that? What are those? Is it Chinese? Fascinating. It's been a while. What language? That's Chinese. It has to be Chinese. Yeah, it's Chinese. That's Chinese. So we've got Chinese, and then we have this is it's got to be Japanese, I think. Has to be. Fascinating. Okay. Yeah, but did I not do Korean? I guess I didn't do Korean. I didn't do Korean. It's interesting. There's a lot of different languages that could still be... There are lots of ways to translate things nowadays online, using the different translation engines that are available. I'll talk about that another time, though. But that article's there. It's got the two different Chinese, the traditional and the simplified Chinese. They're both there. Let's see what happened here. Yeah, they're both there. Ten languages altogether. Now, oh, today's scripture, before we get to the Genesis study, once again, I almost forgot, but Proverbs 23 and 6. Do not feed yourself with the food of anyone of ungenerous eye, nor show yourself craving his tasty dishes. There's an important concept. Do not feed yourself with the food of anyone of ungenerous eye, nor show yourself craving his tasty dishes. His tasty dishes. Do not crave, and do not show yourself craving his tasty dishes. I guess you might not be able to help it if you are craving them, but do not show yourself craving his tasty dishes. Proverbs 23 and 6, do not feed yourself with the food of anyone of ungenerous eye, nor show yourself craving his tasty dishes. Proverbs 23 and 6, it's a principle from the Bible. Because sometimes we think, well, we're offered food, we should accept. But it says here, look, if this person is not generous in their eye, which could mean evil as to eye. In other words, yeah, they're not generous. They don't seem to be generous either to your eye or in the way their eye is looking at you. They're ungenerous, right? Be clear about that, because if you feel that for some reason, for any reason, they're not generous, then that's your cue there to not crave, to not show yourself craving, that is, that person's tasty dishes. Very interesting concept. In other words, if they're not generous, you don't need it. You don't need it anyway. You don't need their help. If they're not generous with their offering, you don't need that. You can get, Jehovah can provide plenty through the hands of a more generous person or through his own ways. Jehovah can provide, just like he provided the sheep for Abraham so that Abraham didn't have to sacrifice his son Isaac. Jehovah can provide. So we don't need to accept offerings from people who are not generous. We just don't need it. In fact, we're commanded not to show ourselves craving it. Right there. So Genesis now, chapter 30. When Rachel came to see that she had borne nothing to Jacob, because we saw in the previous chapter that Jacob's other wife, Leah, had borne sons to him, including the fourth son, Judah. When Rachel came to see that she had borne nothing to Jacob, Rachel got jealous of her sister and began to say to Jacob, "Give me children, or otherwise I shall be a dead woman." At this, Jacob's anger burned against Rachel, and he said, "Am I in the place of God who has held back the fruit of the belly from you?" So she said, "Here is my slave girl, Bilhah. Have relations with her, that she may give birth upon my knees, and that I may get children from her." With that, she gave him Bilhah, her maidservant, as wife, and Jacob had relations with her. And Bilhah became pregnant, and in time bore Jacob a son. Then Rachel said, "God has acted as my judge and has also listened to my voice so that he gave me a son." That is why she called his name Dan. Now, Dan is not the same name as Daniel, you notice. It's slightly different than that. And Bilhah, Rachel's maidservant, became pregnant once more and in time bore a second son to Jacob. Then Rachel said, "With strenuous wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister. I have also come off winner." So she called his name Naphtali. When Leah came to see that she had left off giving birth, she proceeded to take Zilpah, her maidservant, and to give her to Jacob as wife. In time, Zilpah, Leah's maidservant, bore a son to Jacob. Then Leah said, with good fortune. So she called his name Gad. After that, Zilpah, Leah's maidservant, bore a second son to Jacob. Then Leah said, with my happiness, for the daughters will certainly pronounce me happy. So she called his name Asher. Now Reuben went walking in the days of the wheat harvest and got to find mandrakes in the field. So she brought them to Leah, his mother. Then Rachel said to Leah, give me, please, some of your son's mandrakes. At this she said to her, is this a little thing? You're having taken my husband, but you're now taking also my son's mandrakes? So Rachel said, for that reason, he is going to lie down with you tonight in exchange for your son's mandrakes. When Jacob was coming from the field in the evening, Leah went on out to meet him and then said, it is with me you are going to have relations because I have hired you outright with my son's mandrakes. Accordingly, he lay down with her that night, and God heard and answered Leah, and she became pregnant and in time bore to Jacob a fifth son. Then Leah said, God has given me a hireling's wages because I have given my maidservant to my husband. So she called his name Issachar. And Leah became pregnant once more and in time bore a sixth son to Jacob. Then Leah said, God has endowed me, yes, me, with a good endowment. At last my husband will tolerate me because I have borne him six sons. So she called his name Zebulun. And afterward she bore a daughter and then called her name Dinah. Finally, God remembered Rachel, and God heard and answered her in that he opened her womb, and she became pregnant and brought a son to birth. Then she said, God has taken away my reproach. So she called his name Joseph, saying, Jehovah is adding another son to me. And it followed that when Rachel had given birth to Joseph, Jacob immediately said to Laban, send me away, that I may go to my place and to my country. Give over my wives and my children, for whom I have served with you, that I may go. For you yourself must know my service, which I have rendered you. Then Laban said to him, if now I have found favor in your eyes, I have taken the omens to the effect that Jehovah is blessing me due to you. And he added, stipulate your wages to me, and I shall give them. So he said to him, you yourself must know how I have served you and how your herd has fared with me, so that it was little that you actually had before my coming, and it went expanding to a multitude, in that Jehovah blessed you since I stepped in. So now, when am I to do something also for my own house? Then he said, what shall I give you? And Jacob went on to say, you will give me nothing whatsoever. If you will do this thing for me, I shall resume shepherding your flock. I shall continue guarding it. I will pass among your whole flock today. You set aside from there every sheep speckled and with color patches, and every dark brown sheep among the young rams, and any color patched and speckled one among the she-goats. Hereafter such must be my wages, and my right doing must answer for me on whatever future day you may come to look over my wages. Every one that is not speckled and color-patched among the she-goats and dark brown among the young rams is something stolen, if it is with me. To this Laban said, why, that is fine. Let it be according to your word. Then he set aside on that day the he-goats striped and color-patched, and all the she-goats speckled and color-patched, every one in which there was any white, and every one dark brown among the young rams. But he gave them over into the hands of his sons. After that, he set a distance of 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob, and Jacob was shepherding the flocks of Laban that remained over. Then Jacob took for his use staffs still moist of the storax tree, and of the almond tree, and of the plane tree, and peeled in them white peeled spots by laying bare white places which were upon the staffs. Finally, the staffs that he had peeled he placed in front of the flock in the gutters, in the water drinking troughs, where the flocks would come to drink, that they might get into a heat before them when they came to drink. Consequently, the flocks would get in heat before the staffs, and the flocks would produce striped, speckled, and color-patched ones. And Jacob separated the young rams, and then turned the faces of the flocks to the striped ones, and all the dark brown ones among the flocks of Laban. Then he set his own droves by themselves, and did not set them by the flocks of Laban. And it always occurred that whenever the robust flocks would get in heat, Jacob would locate the staffs in the gutters before the eyes of the flocks, that they might get in heat by the staffs. But when the flocks showed feebleness, he would not locate them there. So the feeble ones always came to be Laban's, but the robust ones Jacob's. And the man went on increasing more and more, and great flocks and maidservants and men servants and camels and asses came to be his. So that's the end of Genesis chapter 30, little children. And we saw there how Jacob was treated very, very, what would seem to be badly. Because Laban, by what Laban did, Laban said, okay, you can take all the striped and color patched among the flocks, and all the, and among the rams, you can take all the brown ones. And then Laban proceeded to separate all of the animals that had those qualities and set them aside as part of his own herd. His own, he gave them to his sons and said, keep them away from Jacob's animals. And Laban thought that by doing that, he would prevent Jacob from being allowed to earn anything as a reward for his labor. He thought that, at least that's what it certainly looks like. It appears that way, doesn't it? Does it not? That Laban is attempting to stop Jacob from actually increasing the flocks that belong to Jacob? Because how is Jacob going to ensure that some of the animals born in the flocks of Jacob are actually going to be belonging to Jacob because they have these color-patched portions, or because they're brown among the rams? Well, Jacob came up with the solution. He found the answer, and he used moist branches or staffs from these trees, peeled them in spots so that they had white patches on them. He placed them in front of the flock, and they got in heat while they were looking at these staffs, and that caused them to produce these animals that were of the same characteristic that would then belong to Jacob, because they were specified as being his wages in the agreement that he had with Laban. Even though Laban made the agreement with Jacob, and then he proceeded to separate all of the animals that had that characteristic, that they would belong to Jacob, and to take them for himself and put them in the herds of his sons, so that Jacob would not then have any animals of that characteristic that he could breed. So Jacob had to breed animals which didn't have these striped and speckled and color-patched characteristics, or that they weren't brown among the rams. He didn't have the brown rams characteristic. So all these things didn't stop, or these things he was lacking didn't stop Jacob at all. The fact he didn't have the right, or seemingly didn't have the right color of animals, didn't matter, because Jehovah knew how to produce the correct color of animals from the animals that were present. The ones that were allowed to be there by Laban didn't matter what color they were. Jacob was able to use them to produce great robust flocks, and he also took the more robust animals and he caused them to produce the ones that would belong to him. The ones that were not robust, he allowed them to produce animals that would not belong to him because they had the other characteristics that would cause them to belong to Laban. So the feeble animals always became Laban's, and the robust animals became Jacob's, because he always caused the robust animals to get in heat in front of these color-patched staffs that caused them to be giving birth to the color-patched, striped, and speckled animals, which were then part of Jacob's wages. So Jacob kept on increasing more and more in great flocks, and maid servants and men servants and camels and asses came to be his, it says in verse 43. So that is an amazing, is it not, an amazing story, a phenomenal story of Jehovah's power and how Jacob and his faith in Jehovah allowed him to overcome the complete obstinacy of Laban and his complete lack of willingness to bless Jacob in any way whatsoever. And we saw already how he behaved with regard to allowing Jacob to marry one of his daughters. And then today we saw how he treated Jacob with regard to the wages that he paid Jacob. It was outrageous the way that Laban treated Jacob, was it not? Little children. So that's the end of today's study. It's March 30th, 2023. It's 21:15 hours Eastern Daylight Time. Ward Green with you once again, and tomorrow is another day. We will have a good day. I was out shopping today. I got a lot of work done today because I was out shopping. And, I also, in the morning, I changed my watch straps. I had my leather strap yesterday, and this was on my other arm. This Hamilton watch was on my other arm. I've switched it onto my left arm, but I put a bracelet on it, these bracelets just arrived this morning. So I installed them this morning. Before I went out, I had to take out some links and make it fit my arm. But now I'm realizing that the bracelet itself is very heavy also. And the watch is such a heavy watch that I'm thinking maybe it's better to keep it as leather, because the metal bracelet, it does leave a mark on my arm. It's very heavy. I might get used to it, but this, particularly for this watch, it's okay for the other one. These are my two Swiss watches. The Live watch, this is a Live watch. I'm going to, might call it Dusty, because it's the Moon Dust watch, so I could call it Dusty. And this one I can call Hammy, because Hammy is the name for for any Hamilton watch, actually, can be called a Hammy. Or I can call it Crow for chronograph too. Not sure yet. But this watch is in some ways my favorite, because it's the one that replaces, by its appearance being similar, my 50-year-old watch. So I have a particular amount of love for this one that is hard for any other watch to equal. But it's also because it's a chronograph too, of course, that my other watch, my old watch, was also. But the other thing about this is the if I do put back the leather strap, the leather straps feel better, they're lighter. But I think this one's fine. These are two bracelets from two different manufacturers. There's a company, what's it called? I forget. It doesn't really matter, but I've ordered. What do I have the numbers? Do I have the names written down somewhere? Easy to get? I don't think so. Well, I can check the order. Yeah, I can check the Amazon orders. Let's see. Yeah, right here. Here we go. It's T-strap. This one's a T-strap, and the other one was Fulmosa. And I just put them on. The T-strap actually looks, they're very inexpensive. So you've got, consider this, it's the watch bracelet costs, is that true? Wait a minute. It's 1/100th. It's cost 1/100th the price of the watch. That's how inexpensive the bracelets are, or that's how expensive the watches are, depending on who you say. But that's for this watch. It's not quite, it's more like 1/50th for this one, the bracelet costs compared to the watch. But the thing is, it's not that the bracelet is a bad quality. It's not. It's just that, and also, with this bracelet on, you can't see the workings of the watch looking through the back of the, I don't even know if I was showing you. I haven't been showing you through the proper cam. I've got the new straps on here. I wasn't showing it in the proper window. I'm looking at my iPhone, but I'm not looking at the cropped window. So there's the Live watch, Dusty, and there's Crow, the Hammy watch. But it's got, they both have metal bracelets, whereas they were leather before. So these are the new bracelets. And what I'm going to do now, I'm thinking I might put the leather strap back on for the heavier watch, which is the Hammy. I might call it Crow. I don't know if Crow makes sense. But also, these can come unbuckled too. They can come unbuckled accidentally. So that's not the best thing, right? For it to come unbuckled. They're nice, and these are, they'll be usable for something. Well, also I've got the Russian watch. Either of these would work on the Russian watch as well, because it's got the same bracelet width that these do. So, and I wore the Russian watch today. I didn't wear the Live watch, but I wore the Hamilton and the Russian on my right wrist. So I had to take the links out today to get them to fit my wrist properly. It was quite an exercise, because I wanted to go shopping as well, and I did. I went shopping as well. But it was quite an ordeal today. I mean, it was quite a time crunch, because I wanted to get out before, I got back around 5 o'clock or so, but I wanted to get out at a reasonable time. And I had to get mail. I had to go out and get mail and do. So I accomplished quite a lot of different things today. I mean, normally, you know, this was new technology to me, taking the links out of these. I'd never taken links out of watches in the way that the way these work, with a pin that you extract using the tool they give you, and then you bang it back in again, or you put it back in with the tool. Also, in the case of the Fulmosa, they gave me a tool that I could put it back as well, with a different, more blunt attachment for the tool. You could push the pin back in again in the other direction. So that was quite useful to find out about all these things. I learned a lot about technology today to do with these bracelets. These new bracelets, they latch in a way that my old one didn't on my Casio. And it's got the wrong width. I couldn't use that bracelet because it's the wrong width for these. But if I latch that, this unlatches by pressing on the two sides. My old one, you just pulled it with your thumb. But these are very easy to unlatch, which is probably not the best. Or possibly not the best if you accidentally are pushing on it. You can push on one side, it will unlatch maybe that one side. That's possible, but I think you have to press both sides to unlatch. Then you have to make sure it's latched. This is such a heavy watch. I like it. But I'll have more than one choice when I go, when I am going somewhere or doing different things, because I have more than one watch now. So I'll be able to, I possibly should have just stuck with my Casio watch. But, I mean, as far as it being lightweight, right? But here's the reason, okay? I'll explain the reason. The reason I don't like quartz watches, and in general, I just don't like quartz watches, and it's an unusual reason. I'm aware it's an unusual reason. Because, in fact, quartz watches are more accurate than these watches. Quartz is more accurate. Even the cheapest quartz watch is more accurate than these watches are. Quartz is accurate to about a second per day. Something amazingly accurate like that. 1 second per day, gained or lost. These are only accurate to about 5 seconds a day, gained or lost. In fact, they're not that good right now. They're gaining about 10 or 12, or between 6 and 10, I'd say, seconds a day. Each of these is gaining between 6 and 10 seconds per day. But they're mechanical watches, and part of the joy of a mechanical watch is you get to wind it. It's automatic. It'll wind itself on your wrist, but you get to wind it yourself. And that's a very, to me, satisfying thing. Very satisfying thing. And to know that I'm not dependent on these batteries, which are bad for the environment, because they create, you know, a type of waste, you know, that's not, that's highly undesirable, let's say. It's not desirable, it's highly undesirable to create batteries and have the waste batteries need to be recycled and all of that. It creates, it's the wrong, you know, let's just say it's the wrong maybe it's not a question of right or wrong even. It seems to me to be the wrong, or it's not as desirable, let's put it that way. Just it's highly undesirable to create all kinds of waste products when you build things. For example, the old gasoline-powered cars, they recycled everything in those cars. They sold them to junkyards, and they sold parts and so on. The new electrical cars, you can't just take a battery and throw it in the junkyard, or take it apart and you know and just throw parts around. It's got to be recycled in a special facility. Batteries have to be processed in a specific way. You know, it requires technology of a very advanced nature, and maybe in the future batteries will not be the problem they are now, but right now batteries are going to create such a big problem in the near future, and they already are creating a big problem with recycling. And that's why I don't want to support that technology particularly, you know. So I don't want to get a fancy quartz watch, which I could get for like $100 instead of paying $2,000. I could, you know, pay $100, but I could also buy an automatic watch for, even from Seiko, for probably a reasonable, or a much more reasonable price than some of these Swiss watches. But you can pay easily. I mean, Rolex has a new watch out. They're, I think it was, I saw it today for $7,500 Canadian. It's just a plain watch with a beautiful dial on it, it's their bubble watch with the colorful bubbles on the front. $7,500 Canadian, they're offering it. It's a lot of money though, $7,500. And that's just it's a Rolex though, but it's just a plain watch. It doesn't have chronograph, nothing. But it's a wind-up, you know, or an automatic. It's got the power of a spring, not a battery. That's what I like about the watches that I've been buying, is that they're spring-powered, and that's why they're so interesting to me, because I recently just got my old watch from 50 years ago out of storage and started using it, and then I thought, well, this is the way to go. This is the way to do it. Why are we going in the direction of batteries? I'm not saying we're going to be going away from batteries in the future. I'm sure we won't be. I'm just saying it's of much greater interest to me, the historical part, and the intricacies of these mechanical movements are just far more interesting to me. I know that there are a lot of interesting things about quartz watches, and I'll probably get interested, or possibly get interested in them. I mean, I'm interested. I'm very interested in quartz watches. Don't get me wrong. Okay, I'm interested in, but not to purchase them. I'm very interested in the quartz technology. I'm just for one thing, I'm not as interested right now, but I am interested because I know they're phenomenal. Their accuracy is phenomenal. So I'm very interested in the technology. I'm just, that doesn't mean that I can actually buy it conscientiously and enjoy it. I'm just enjoying the mechanical technology that I guess I, in a sense, I grew up with it. It was available when I was younger, but I couldn't afford to buy it. So it was out of my reach when I was younger. And now I'm finally seeing it as attainable. I'm not going to, I don't think I'll keep growing my collection. I just think it's going to be something that I've taken my 50-year-old watch. It was one single piece, and now I'm replacing it with several pieces, a few more than one watch, you know. And then that will be my new collection that will go forward maybe another 50 years, and then I'll replace that with something else. You know, who knows? I don't know. But the goal really is more about how to live for 50 years than it is about what watch anybody is choosing to use, I suppose. But these watches can last more than 50 years if they're maintained regularly every so many years, every 5 years or so. But they require service, and the service has to be done by a qualified person or somebody who knows what they're doing. And it costs some significant amount of money if you pay someone else to do it. So I might want to learn how to maintain my own watches is another possible idea. So that's it for today. I think that was very unfortunate. I'm very sorry about this typographical error in paragraph 5.5. I have a feeling, though. It's funny how subconsciously we know these errors are there. And maybe I even noticed it consciously at one time, but I was so busy I couldn't fix it. I didn't have time. Well, I've certainly seen similar errors before that I did correct, too. But this is an error, the repetition of the word "the." It reminds me of that little triangle. We used to have a triangle in which we'd write Paris in the, and then the spring. Paris in the spring. And when you read it, it looked like Paris in the spring. And almost everybody read it as Paris in the spring. They didn't see the repetition of the word "the." But that was because of the way it was written in the triangle. Paris in the spring. But this is not like that. This is obvious that it's a typo. It's maybe it's not wrong either, because it's the Exodus is the name of the event. So we could call it, we wouldn't say this, but you could call it this. The way it's written could be the way you call it. It's very plausible that it could be called in that way, just the way it's written. But you'd never say it that way because it sounds like you're repeating the word "the," which it seems wrong to do in that context. Interesting. Have a wonderful day, all of you. I love you. And hopefully see you again tomorrow. Bye for now.